So I'm of two thoughts, whether I should turn up the knob of silence between, you know, this was supposed to be a silent retreat, whether I should turn that knob up or whether I should let you go as you are. Because mostly, at least the people I know here are very mature in their practice, and it doesn't upset me that you're speaking between, but it can also be helpful to be quiet. So I'm going to kind of leave it up to you, I think. But don't be drawn into conversation just for the sake of conversation. All right? And then we'll kind of navigate that tomorrow a little bit. So usually I'm much stricter than that. It's my age. So if there are any questions or comments or whether you, some dialogue that you'd like to have, I'd be open to anything of that sort, sharing. Yes?
So I'm still growing up.
You what?
I'm still growing up, and I am curious to know, when should I make my sits just focused on, you know, coming back to my breath and disciplining my mind versus when should I apply inquiry? When should I face an emotion? When should I face, oh, I'm feeling something in my heart right now. What is that? And turn to that.
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. It's a little bit of a question. I can't really answer it as I know you would like that when this happens, you do that. It's not as mechanical as that. It's more art than mechanical. And sometimes you realize that the mind is kind of buzzing. You're not centered. It's not a time to do inquiry. It's really a time to just collect yourself and center yourself. Now, the problem with that is that centering is a continuum that goes on forever. I mean, it goes from here for infinity. And people sometimes get, because the more you get on it, the more pleasurable it is, the stronger it is, and you can convince yourself of the same logic, well, I'm not centered enough, and you just keep going in that direction and never really come back to the fact that it's sufficient. So remembering that, at the same time, if there's just a lot, if you're lost in a lot of buzz of your thinking, you're just not going to be able to, well, you can try inquiry, but you've got to have quiet. You've got to be still to look within. And if you can't do that, then you probably need a little more stability. All right? But don't wait for absolute quiet before you ask yourself questions. When there's something burning in you, listen to this, because this is important. The passion behind the question is itself, will itself resolve itself in silence, will bring silence. When you're really interested in something, you're listening to it. And that's quiet. That's by definition quietude, see? So if you don't ask yourself a question and you're all buzzing around, then you're buzzing around and you need to center yourself. If you do ask yourself and there's a bunch of buzzing around, how intensely do I really want to know this question? How passionately do I want to know? You can't pretend that. That's growth, growing up. You'll grow into your passion. You'll grow into quiet. You'll grow into the questions. But the questions should always be yours, right? Why can't I listen? Why am I always interfering? I mean, it can be anything, but it can be psychological, it can be mechanical, it can be practical, it can be anything. But just take, you know, why is it that I can't quiet down? That self is an inquiry. Why is my mind so buzzing? Well, if you look at, I do this a lot when it's buzzing. I say, I need myself. That's why I'm buzzing. I like it. I like feeling about, I feel like feeling myself. It doesn't convince me, it may most of you, but it doesn't convince me that I'm back again. But it's kind of pleasurable, and I don't want to be in it. Okay, so I just let it go, you know, just let the buzzing, you know, and then a little bit childish, but it's kind of like having a tantrum. You know, don't interrupt my tantrum. Even though there's a part of you that knows it's just, right? You see how it just moves itself. So wherever there's a disturbance, but I'm not willing to give up the disturbance to ask a question about it. I like the disturbance too much. That's really why we stay noisy. Whatever it is that's generating the noise, we like it. Or we don't like it, and that's the alternative, but the same. The aversion of it, right? Don't tell me the president is... how did I answer that question? Not very well. But it's the best I could do.
So I tried to do some inquiry along the lines when you said, you know, the assumptions we have about ourselves, and you did, you know, one where it's like, I'm worthless, I'm this, I'm that, I'm that. And I came up with one of those I am statements, and my eyes popped open, and I felt this shift in my body, and I thought, oh my gosh, that's it.
Good.
That's it.
Yeah.
And then I was wondering, in terms of working with that, to extinguish it, even though it's never fully gone.
Okay, now stop talking.
Okay.
Okay, because I don't want you to go any further, because what you're asking me is something very important for me to answer. So even that may not be the intention of your question, it's where I have to answer. Okay, so when you find that self-assumption, you know, mine was, there's something wrong with me. When I got there, I went, oh man, this is familiar. You know, and I didn't know it at the beginning, but then just through seeing where judgments go and all of that, I thought, oh, there's something wrong with me. So when you find yours, the first thing you want to do is be, do you know what a cultural anthropologist is? You're in a new culture called my self-assumption. You want to know that landscape. You want to know the emotions that arise, what you're saying, that all the different tributaries of that mainstream, how something wrong with me turns into I hate myself, or I can never get it right, or all of the different ways that I actively live that assumption. And it will amaze you how thoroughly that assumption is displayed in your action, speech, and mind. It's just amazing how, I won't say universal, but one step less, how prevalent that is. And you want to take notes. You want to do it as an innocent bystander of it, not trying to interfere with it, not trying to change it, not trying to do anything to it. You are a bare observer of it. You're getting the culture down. You're getting the language down. You're getting everything down. The situations, okay? So that's the first way to approach it. So you know the landscape of it. Now already you've taken off a lot of steam because you've exposed yourself over and over and over to it. You just haven't gone deeply into the abiding furnace of it yet. And that's the next step. So get the landscape, okay?
What's the next step?
Well, I said that earlier about going into, you know, when you're feeling you're in the middle of that belief, you don't disturb it. You let the ashes from that fire come out of your consciousness. I hate myself. I can't stand all of the, see, there's, within each cell of our body, I believe, is the crux of that story. It's still in our body. And so it comes out with story. Now, usually we say, face the emotion and let the thoughts go. Okay? That's the way that the teaching is taught in the beginning phase. Just be with your emotion. Don't judge it. Don't add anything to it, right? This one is it's a step up from, or step down in depth. It's being with the emotion and allowing the accompanying story that's buried with it to arise. So we're not cutting the emotion off from the story that accompanies it. And so it all comes up together. And it comes up burning because it was sent down burning. It comes up burning. It's like the molten lava of the earth. It's been covered. So it's still as hot as it ever was, and it comes out as volcanoes. It's a very good analogy, actually, to how we spout our, right? So it's hot like that. But if you just feel the emotion, the story also has to be healed. And when we allow the emotion and the story to come up, and sometimes it's pictures and images, then there's nothing else down there that can convince you of anything. If you do just the emotion, the story remains itself and will come up again because you haven't convinced yourself that the story is untrue. Just trust me on this one, okay? Okay. That's as good as I can do on that. Hayden, right here. Right there.
Hi, Hayden.
Could you talk a little bit about the ebb and flow of form and formlessness and form after formlessness and kind of the stickiness of form?
Yeah. I could go on and on for that. 2 weeks, a month, I could just go. Let me just... I have a book you got to read. The last book I wrote is actually the deepest and most profound book I've written, and it's the one that the fewest people have read. And so I talked to my publisher and I said, why are the sales so lagging? And he said, because it's too deep. It's scary. The deeper you go, the more you lose readership. Because the people don't want to go there. What helps is if you, on Amazon, recommend it. Then people will buy it not knowing. So form and formlessness, okay, so in Zen, they say form is form, and form is formless, and formless is form. I don't know. They do all these different, you know, anyway. So form is what we know. We know that it's the expression of invested thought in life, right? Glasses, right? Why do we know these are glasses? Because I've had pairs of glasses. These are reading glasses. I bought them from Costco. You know, I know all about glasses. There's my history. So the form is recognition. Form and recognition are really the same thing. It's not what the eye sees. It's what the eye remembers it has seen. So what is the? Where is the I have seen? Inquiry. Where's the I have seen? Is it here? Is I have seen here? No. I have seen is not here. I have seen is my past influencing the present, right? Okay, so why is the past influencing the present? That's not presence. That's not now. That's the past. As long as I know this only as glasses, then the past has its say. And I will forever be living in the present with the past, and the past will confiscate the present. Now let me just let that sink in for a minute. That's the definition of suffering. Because now I break these. God damn it! Okay, so is there another way? As long as this remains recognition only, there isn't. But if there's perception, And recognition and perception are seen as two things that are happening simultaneously, the seeing and perceiving and the remembrance of it. I can release the need to remember it as what it has always been. I don't forget that. I can always use them skillfully. But that doesn't confiscate the whole thing into a recognition, past and present. See? God, I hope these don't get broken. They're the only pair I have. You see? Worry, anticipation, expectation. Okay, that's all embedded in form, because I made form from my recognition. You see, I created it. I know you. Boy, what last conversation we had wasn't very pleasant. I don't know how, you know, it's like that. I never see you again. Never. Not with innocent eyes. Okay. So now we're cleaning up the mess we've made of ourselves. So now I have to go, if I'm really sincere, and this happens on its own, I don't have to force myself to, I have to go where recognition isn't. I want to go there. I'm not afraid of going there. I want to go there because I see how it's everything. You see, it's based on my, it's based on my realization of how the past is influencing the present. And I can't stand that. I want to know what the present is because this is where I live. This is where existence is. If I can't get to existence without the mud of my past, then it's, I have no chance here. I have no choice. So where does existence, where is existence free of the past? That's an inquiry. And it sends awareness on a mission. Recognition, stillness, pre-thought. There's a beautiful passage in the Sutta Nipata about where the Buddha says, it's not disordered perception, it's not ordinary perception, it's not the lack of perception. He tells you everything. See, it's not disordered perception. You don't see these as, they don't have, they still have meaning. But it's not ordinary perception in that it's only the meaning that I see. So now I can live in the world, use these when they're needed, and not be enslaved to the past of which they represent. Does that make sense? Now the form has merged into the formless because these things were never form. They were always created into form by my recognition of them. And if I let that recognition go, they go back into the formless. And the formlessness is all the single, is the single essence of things. It's where the heart dwells. It's where there is complete contentment. Because it's, there's not the, what's down there to create any, you're not down there with it. You're this is pre-verbal. You lost yourself up here. That's why I say there's only one obstacle here. The sense of you and me. That's this. It will never tolerate this. It thinks it needs to stay alive to protect you. It's not evil. It thinks it needs this to protect you. And until it ventures somewhere where you're not, it will continue to hold that conviction. And then you'll slip down here someday and see you're not needed at all. And then it's like, open the windows, let the air in. I was suffocating. Is that good enough?
I'll try to ask this question. I don't feel grounded with it yet. It's sort of percolating, but the conflict that you get into between the mind and the heart, when the heart is stimulated by, because we're never alone when these things happen, we're with other people usually. When another person or event stimulates the heart and you feel sort of volcanic and the mind says, don't do anything. And then later on you say, why didn't I do something? Or just the reverse. You do something and later on the mind says, why'd you do that? How do you resolve that conflict between the mind and the heart?
Okay, so again, there's no single answer to this. Here's my own path through that dilemma. All right, I would do something, I'd lose myself, get reactive or something, and then I think, oh, where are all these years of Dharma practice? You know, it's such a failure. So I back away from it. I say, okay, let me. I believe a lot in reflection, and that's not often taught, but I'll bring this up again. I will reconjure in my mind what just happened and see, because when you do it in actual time, even though it was a memory that you're doing it, you're feeling it in real time. And so you start feeling where you lost yourself. And you go, okay, it's the losing itself, that myself, that is the problem, not my responses. My responses came from the reaction of having lost myself. So let me go back to where it is that I lost myself. And it was in, you know, that person's conversation evoked a sense of my unworthiness or my defensives. There is where I lost myself. And whatever response came out of that probably wasn't very skillful because it was defensive. So let me just look at that. But I don't want to look at my response and judge it. I want to look at where I lost myself. Because that's whatever response I give from there on is going to be off. If I can recover myself in those moments so that I don't lose myself when that happens again, whatever response occurs with me not losing myself is going to be much healthier for all parties. And therefore much less self-condemnation and judgment associated with it. Okay? So go in the wise direction, not so much on your comments, but on where it is, what caught you up in that moment.
Not that it necessarily happens very often, but wouldn't you say that the same, or would you say that the same reflection is important when you do feel like you got it right? You know, we spend an awful lot of time just, trying to understand what's wrong with us, and we don't spend very much time appreciating the things that are actually worthy in our actions.
That's really an important point. In fact, let me broaden it out a little bit, but it's a very... How many people appreciate their generosity? Some of us do, and I congratulate you, but most of us think of ourselves, the things that we do that are generous, like open the door for somebody or helping somebody else, we don't even think about, we don't let that in as, oh, well, I was just kind in that moment. I want to encourage all of us to acknowledge those moments when we're uplifting, where we're kind, where we're generous, where we're genuinely listening, we're connected, you know, we're honest, whatever, okay? And so those moments are going to have their own reward because those are transcendent moments. You can't be totally in yourself and be generous. That's why you feel good about what you just did, because that's what the Absolute gives you all the time, is joy, right? And so you got a little peephole of the gift of the Absolute. Oh, it felt so good to give, huh? Or to be honest, you know? Even though it may come back at you, and I don't mean honesty. The Buddha said, don't say what is true without saying what, coupling it with what's true and useful. So it's not just the truth, because you're fat and you're ugly and you're this. You know, that may be true to you, but it's not useful to anybody. So timing is part of that calculation, and just consideration and heartfelt. See, that brings in the art. That's the art. That's the connection. Anybody can stand back and say what is true to him or her about that person in the abstract. But to be connected, you have to bring in heart, and heart will allow it to be framed in what's useful. Okay? So if you're saying what is true and you should feel good about that, you may not, because where was it coming from? You know, just you're going to be honest and to hell with anything else. But I don't find moments of genuine, when I come from a transcendent value, which I'll speak more about tomorrow, there's not a lot of flack up here about that moment. You know, every time I go to Trader Joe's, it costs me $5 extra because I give it to the real chain. I mean, that may come up, but it's not really too. The next time I trade Joe's, I do the same damn thing. It doesn't. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, and that's just the way I trained myself for 70 years, to be miserly. So I'm not interested in miserliness. So, but I can't expect it not to be there. It just doesn't matter. It has to not matter to us. Okay, I'm going to shoot you out there. I've shot you out there a few times today. We are not responsible for what the mind is doing, for the thoughts we're having, the emotions we're feeling, the judgments, none of it. We are not responsible. It is conditioning. It's how we learn to live in our past. And this is the result. That's all that we are, is the assumption, all of that stuff going on. And then we make it, oh, I'm a miser. Well, if you just, you let yourself be a miser, because you're not going to change it. You can try to change it, and you can even modify it, but it doesn't make it any difference. You're still going to come up in some form. And so let that happen, and be accountable that you don't hold yourself as a miser. That's the accountability, is to let it go. You see, it's not responsible and letting it go. If it's not responsible, then you're not letting it go. If it's back there, you know, God, why am I such a miser? I've got to learn. Then that's just being a miser in reverse. Reverse miser. See how tricky this is? It's all sticky. It's very sticky. Yeah, but sticky's okay. That's why teaching is, you know, watch, you know, get sticky here. Am I babbling? I feel like I'm babbling. Okay, thanks, Candace. There's a question over. There's two of them here. It takes stamina to do these things, these non-residentials. It's like track training for a marathon. I haven't been running.
So it seems to me like a lot, and particularly the things that we beat ourselves up over, that there's a concept that I will say I'm not well-versed in Buddhism, but Christianity, which is compassion. And that's my question, is it seems like in order to be able to face these things, to get into these states where we're observing them, be detached from them, we have to be kind to ourselves, and how to do that.
Well, could I ask, are you new to practice, or have you been practicing?
I've actually been in kind of... I haven't read the teachings, I think.
You haven't
I haven't read the teachings, but I've done a fair amount of meditation.
And for how long?
Oh, 20 years meditation. 20 years. Yes.
That's fine.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Just needed to get a sense of the experience level. Okay, so so I was doing my 3-month course, my first one, back in 1976, and I was staying on afterwards as what they called then a long-term yogi. And metta, I really wanted to do metta. So I wanted basically compassion. I wanted to have a heart, and I didn't feel like I was. I feel like during all that time of sitting, I was just kind of, it was my practice. I was gonna make myself do this and make myself do that. I wanted some softness, which is really your question, isn't it? Okay, so, it was Christmas, around Christmas. That's when the 3-month course ended, and we went into... But I stayed on over Christmas, and I thought, okay, Jesus, right? I didn't have... There was nothing negative or positive about Jesus. It was an inspiration for my heart to work in that direction. And so I said, okay, where's Christ's love? I want to... And I felt miserable. The more I asked that question, the more isolated and miserable I felt, because I didn't feel like I had access to it. I felt I was limited. And I got more miserable. Christmas Day, I was like, oh. But anyway, I'm not asking for your sympathy 50 years ago. But it's like, okay, I'm doing something wrong. Let me be gentle. No, I was doing the practice as I had practiced the 3-month course. You see, you can't ram compassion down your throat. So let me be tender where I am. Not in some kind of abstract way. It's how I pick up these glasses. Just let me be tender. Does that word work for me? The word really worked for me. So I said, okay, tenderness, isn't that an aspect of love? It certainly feels like it. So then I just exercised tenderness when I could, but not demanding it. Anytime I demanded it, the opposite would come in. How my lack of tenderness, I'm not good enough in tenderness. So I didn't demand it. I just, okay, this is a moment I can be tender. So tender took me to sensitivity, it took me to refinement, tasting, it took me into awareness. It took me into aliveness. So that was my access. Compassion felt too distant. I didn't even know what it meant, and it felt so far away, but something immediate, accessible. And I just found the word tender to be an access point. So find your access point. And not demand it from you. Just be very patient is an access point. See, we use access points to access points. So you're going to be tender, you've got to be patient. Now patience is another access point. Isn't that beautiful?
So following up on that, at least intellectually, it seems like there's a bit of a paradox, though in actuality, I don't think that there is. But so I'm going to say this, and then I'm interested in what you would add to it or what you would say. It seems like suffering, like our own suffering is sort of the gateway to compassion. So, you know, to know our own suffering, to really experience it, then we can really be compassionate to other people. So to me, there's a bit of it, I don't want to suffer, so why should I go there in the first place? That's the intellectual paradox, but then, like, having settled into it a little bit in my practice, my experience is that is what actually happens.
What actually happens?
Is suffering is sort of a gateway to having more compassion.
Okay, I got that. Okay. All right, so that's what is said. You know, compassion is a response to suffering, of pain. But, okay, they're all... this is where words just... They're all... it's not similes. They're all... similar to or the same as or whatever as love. Okay, they're expressions of love in different disguises. There's love. That's when love touches suffering, there's compassion. When love touches somebody who is succeeding and you feel mudita or joy in their success, you see? But love is the basis. That's where all the different expressions of love come from. From love, compassion, mudita, even equanimity, all of them, okay? So if you want to work on compassion, you can do it in two ways. You can look externally to the sufferings of the world and just feel this collective compassion for the pain that we're generating. But eventually you have to look inside yourself and feel that same tenderness. And if you can't, it's because you're interrupting the connection between yourself and your own suffering. You might say you're deserving of that suffering. And then there's that ends compassion. Because you're getting what you deserve, you're not going to feel compassion for yourself. So you may have to work on what obstructs your connection to your suffering to feel self-compassion. Which is fine. We all have to do that eventually in whatever ways, and we're looking for those intrusions of psychology on whatever it is that we're doing. In this case, it's to be self-compassionate. And now we're just going to, once we start breaking that apart so that I can feel self-compassion, you'll be amazed at how flowering your compassion becomes for others. And there are judgment, for instance. When you're judging somebody else's qualities, it's because you don't like those qualities in you. So there's no compassion there for that particular quality. If you look at our current president, if we're contracted around that person's character, look at yourself. Where are you? Not to that degree, but where are you dishonest? Where are you dishonest? And how does that sit with you when you are? Because that's what we're reacting to. Otherwise, who cares? He means nothing. Not to our spiritual life. So you're always looking back when there's a blockade. You're always looking to let the water flow, especially around something as important as your connection to other people. And it's always self-generated. Whatever I'm feeling about that other person isn't coming from them, it's coming from me. And my recognition and stuckness within a particular expression that person is bringing out in me. So this feedback loop needs to be ongoing. And we have nothing but opportunities in this day and age. We're looking at ways to become more quiet. Let's not become too abstract in what we're doing here. Everything we're doing is towards stillness. Less self-conversation. That is where everything resides. That is where the heart is. Not in abstract form, but in reality.
I feel a little bit that I'm throwing myself on a limb sharing this, but the experience, I think, surprised me. And so I just want to share the second question, what remains when...
You have no problems?
Yeah, yeah. I think it was a step-by-step process as I brought up what was inside. And something that always is with me as I work on just on things is that, you know, I would probably say like an inner child coming up, and it's just always with me. I always feel like that's a very clever child that always figures out every time I feel like I make progress in my practice, man, it's there. And it figures out kind of, you know, a backdoor entrance of how it's going to stay in control.
Good.
And so that came up for me as a worry, as all these positive words and experiences came up for me in that question that was always there. And then I just found myself acknowledging it.
Yes, beautiful.
And then eventually turning to it.
Good.
And validating it.
Yes.
And that's probably going to be part of my experience for a long time. I don't know. So I just wanted to share that.
No, that's beautiful. I'm not going to add anything to that because it's a statement in itself. And that's exactly how it works. You uncover something that has been there forever, and it surprises you at first. You turn to it, and you think, God, this thing's forever. It'll be forever. And then you turn to it, and you lighten with it. And I'm not going to tell you what then happens. I want you to experience what happens, you know, as you turn to it, and you just, come on in. come on in. It's like, Jesus, come on, everybody, there's room for everybody here. Right? Okay, all. I got one shot at you a year. So... Anna here is going to remind me if I don't talk about Donna, she's going to make me do it. So staying within your means is very important to me. Sometimes people get inspired and give beyond their means. I do not want Donna to be that, for you to have that relationship. What I love about Sims, I've always loved about Sims, is that the heart of Sims, and may it always be embellished, is that we never turn away people based upon their ability to pay. That's just so... Here in this room, we have like 4 or 5 former presidents of the board, plus countless board members. That's part of you all. And each one of them, if there was a tenet to making Sims go forward, it was establishing on that fact. And sometimes we didn't have a lot of money. A lot of times we didn't have a lot of money. But that never changed. Isn't that great? I just love that. Now, come on, everybody. Now we're like this. So if you have means to give, we have Donna for Sims that you can give extra, or we have Donna for me that you can give as well. Is that good enough? I thank you in advance. Okay, let's just be quiet for a few minutes. I want to say, you can see you don't have to spend the whole day sitting and walking to have a deep experience of the Dharma. Understand that, that it's much closer than the labor you offer it. If you're interested in the truth, not in your work ethic, may you all live in joy and contentment.